بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello, Said. Give the zikr. Your call, Sheikh Al-Karib, and watch him the same. عليه السلام اكشف كربي بحق اخيك الحسين عليه السلام. There was a scholar in Tehran, he's passed away now. He was very revolutionary in the time of the Shah. I'm not sure if you've heard of Nawab Safavi. But when Nawab Safavi entered the Iranian parliament, this particular scholar divorced himself from even the likes of Nawab Safavi because he didn't accept the idea of entering parliament when there's a Taghuti system ruling. What I didn't know about this scholar was he was a student of Muhammad Taqi Omari, who was a student of Irfan of Sayyid Ali Qazi. And he never told me. The way I got introduced to him was before going to home, one of the scholars in London, he said to me, there's someone in Tehran, go and sit down in the mosque, but don't approach him. Don't speak with him. If it's necessary, he will speak with you. So I was very thirsty for knowledge and everything. So you could imagine, so when I went to Iran, the first thing I went to the mosque and I spoke with him and introduced myself. Everything that that scholar said not to do. And then he said, whenever you come to Tehran, come and see me. I wasn't his student because he wouldn't accept students anymore. But he also gave this dhikr. And he said 133 times. So he belonged to the tariqah of Sayyid Ali Qazi. But through the student, Ayatollah Muhammad Taqi Omari. He also gave another instruction. Maybe this is the first time I'm sharing this. I think I've said this before. Or if I did, I can't remember. Because that first bit is very important. And in proportion to you leading an Abbasi life, that bit will have results. And it's very commonly accepted, even those who are not in the tariqah, they have accepted such a thing. And it has many results. He said that every lunar month, which begins with a Monday, so in a lunar calendar, if the first day of the month is a Monday, is a prescription. And it's in the Ahadith too, that you recite Surah number 56, Waqi'a. And on day one, if it's a Monday, you recite Surah Waqi'a once. And there are small du'as to recite after every time you recite the Surah, you recite that small du'a too. On day two of that month, you recite Surah Waqi'a twice. On day three, three times. On day four, four times. Up to day 14. When you have to recite it 14 times. And he said, the result is that Allah, through cause and effect, will send a lot of sustenance down to you. From places that you weren't expect. Now this much I've said before. What I'm about to say now, I don't think I've said. Not that I kept it, you know, secret or anything. It's just something which sometimes you forget. When he said this to me, he said, and I, referring to himself, from day 15 onwards, I do the same protocol in reverse manner. So on day 15, he would recite Surah Al-Waqi 14 times. Then on day 16, 13 times until the 12, 11, 10, one time. But he said, I do that. He said this. Yes. So by that, I understood that it's not for me. Some things are maybe one is not ready. These are like medication sometimes. But this is not to be found in the Ahadith. Now, as I say, we don't have access to all the Ahadith. Some are kept private among certain tariqas. They don't disclose it. He never said it's a hadith or not. But I never found this, and I investigated it to some degree. This reverse recital of Surah Waqi from 14 to 1 in the same month, he said, I do that. And I never practiced that at all. And then many years passed. Now, remember, I didn't know he was a Suluki student of the Tariq of Sayyid Ali Bhatti through Ayatollah Muhammad Taghi Omari. Many years passed and he passed away. And then I only got to find out afterwards. One of his sons told me, now that son, I knew this up, but maybe he was told not to tell anyone, I don't know. And I then said to the son that his instruction of the reverse manner, did he ever tell you? The son, he said, yes, actually. He told me to, but since it's not in the Ahadith, I was scared to execute it, the son said. And that's okay. But there was someone who, and we wanted to know what the reason for this reciting in the reverse order, in addition to 1 to 14, what was the philosophy behind it? And I tried to investigate this. I came to an answer with one of his students, but at the end of the day, it wasn't direct from him. As I say, I wasn't his student, but there were some who were very close. And what happened was someone practiced this without his permission. And one said, I do this. Even I, as a novice, understood that. That's for him. He gave me an instruction. But the rest he said, I do this, that it's not for me. But someone did this in reverse fashion. And hopefully you will do it. What happened was, he lost half of his wealth. And apparently, although we can't say this 100%, that the reverse fashion is all your haram wealth that you have will be taken away from you. And haram has degrees, but all of it will be taken away from your wealth. It requires a true arif to be ready to do this. But when he said, I do this, because he doesn't want to live with any, even ambiguous wealth. He wants the wealth to go. Nian Yu don't have that courage, but he had it. So this was just one memory I had when I gave this lit. I thought to share with you this memory that I had with this particular scholar. Now, also in the Tariqa, So for these two invocations, well, one invocation, one instruction, all in the Tariqa of Sayyid Ali Bhatti, The third is Ziyarat al-Ashura. I was surprised that, although maybe I came late, but Ziyarat al-Ashura wasn't recited today or yesterday. If you had listened to what I said and quoted Sayyid Ali Ghadi, it should have been recited. But anyway, Ziyarat al-Ashura is incredibly important. And this tariqah has made a lot of emphasis on it. And then sometimes there are people in Iran or elsewhere, they belittle the status. When I say Iran, the overwhelming majority, everyone is for Ziyarat al-Ashura. Jim, you may find scholars sometimes in Iran, outside Iran. And they speak about Ziyarat al-Ashura in very light terms, and they even belittle it. It's as if the audience, after listening to what they have to say, oh, so let's not recite it. Even a close family member of mine, when she heard of something which an Iranian scholar had said, she refrained from reciting the last three or four sentences. The ones about the Allahumma khusna. And this is very incredible because this ziyara is something which a true Shia has to live with this 365 days a year. Now, we sometimes may not understand some of the hidden dimensions of Ziyarat al-Ashura. I'll open one of those dimensions tonight. But before I do, I just want to explain to you why this is very false, and this way of speaking and belittling and underplaying the significance of Ziyarat al-Ashura is doing a great disservice. And I want to humbly suggest that you, though, take this very seriously. Whenever you encounter a particular du'a, the first question that comes to mind is, does it have a sanad or not? Meaning, does it have a chain of narrators or not? Chain of narrators are, for example, someone in the 4th century after Hijra, in the 4th century, so it's close to after the minor occultation. They say that X has narrated, A has narrated from B, who narrated from C, who narrated from D, who narrated from E, who narrated from the Imam, for example, after a number of chain of narrators are mentioned. Now, sometimes you may see some hadiths, A narrated from B, narrated from C, who narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, or Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Okay, you say, well, look, three chains is too little, you need a bit more time. This is a science. Sheikh Tusi, for example, who was one of the scholars in the 4th century, 5th century, when he said, A said, who narrated from B, who narrated from C, who narrated from the Imam, that A is already the introduction of his books of biography. He gives the chain there. He doesn't always give all the names for every hadith. But by A, it includes a number of transmitters. If that number is only three and he doesn't include anyone else, we call that incomplete. Because the chain of transmission is incomplete. With three, you don't get to them. You need six or seven. So does this du'a have a sanad, a chain of narrators, or not? And if it does, is it complete or not complete? And finally, the narrators themselves, are they reliable, trustworthy, or not? And there are one or two other small parameters. It's a very deep science. I'm not an expert in it. And then if all these are met, you say this has a strong chain of transmission. It's strong. If it's incomplete, or the one or two or more transmitters who were not trustworthy, you see, it's weak. I'm generalizing. You see, it's weak. It has a chain of narrators, but it's not complete. Okay. Now, in relation to the strong chain of transmitters, sometimes there are discrepancies. For example, in Ziyarat al-Ashura, there are discrepancies in the wording. And the overwhelming majority say in Ziyarat al-Ashura, the exact wording isn't the word of the Imam, 100%. Yes, the meaning is conveyed, but we can't say 100% that this is exactly the word of the Imam. Most of the ahadith we have is like this. Now, look, does Ziyarat al-Ashura have a sanad which is strong and complete? There's a difference of opinion. Some experts in Najjar, like Baytullah Shubayri Zanjani, said, yes, we've looked at the sanad, the chain, we've looked at all the transmitters, and it is complete. And he gives the names, and he gives his proofs. For some, they question aspects of the chain, and that's okay. But it's not substantiated. But that doesn't mean, I'll come to, if the chain of transmission is weak, I'll come to that in a minute. Let's focus on the strong. So when there are differences of opinion, why should someone just come without giving their proofs and say, it's not authentic? That's poison. Whoever does that to you is giving you poison. And whoever does that to your children, they're poisoning them. That's very unfair to speak like that. So, with a strong chain of transmission, sometimes the wording, or mostly the wording, we can't say is exactly the same as the Imam's. And that's why with Ziyarat al-Ashura, there are different ways of reciting it, and the sentences differ amongst the different scripts that we have, even though they all are from Sheikh Tusi, from Ibn Ulawi, who was connected to the time of infallibility. But as it has evolved, there are differences. And the number of chains, the different chains, which all affirm Ziyarat al-Ashura, but the wording differs amongst them. So it's complete chains, more than one, through different narrators, and you see there's a difference in wording. But the main gist, the main meanings are conveyed in all of them. There are some du'as that you can say no. Maybe more than 90% we're sure it's exactly the same wording. For example, du'a Kumail. The Amir al-Mu'min says to Kumail, Uktub, write it down. Word by word, it was written. Here, the probability that it's exactly the word of the Imam is very much stronger. So this is just, we're now saying whether it's the Imam's word exactly. The fact that it's a strong chain, it's a given. But sometimes amongst strong chains of transmission, the wording is the Imam's wording 100%. Sometimes, mostly, it's not. But that doesn't affect the strong chain of transmission, though. That doesn't affect the fact that it has a sanad, a chain of transmission. There it is. Or du'a iftitah in the month of Ramadan, attributed to the 12th Imam. That was also written. And the deputies wrote it. That's very legitimate. Now, some scholars may say, yes, du'a iftitah, it's all good, but this last part we don't accept. Because it says, Allahumma inna nashku ilayk. O Allah, we complain to you. And they don't, they say, no, why would the Imam say that? See, the wording is far from the wording of an infallible. These people, they don't understand what complaining means. Then hold on with Nabi Ya'qub alayhi salam in Surah Yusuf, where he says that Inna ma ashku bathi wa huzni ila Allah. One two verses before, Ya asafa ala Yusuf. Ya'qub's separation from Yusuf was difficult. Yusuf was a stronger manifestation of Allah's attributes. Whenever you're distanced from a human being who is manifesting Allah's attributes, it's a source of sorrow. But the source of sorrow is not for the dunya. It's not out of greed that you've lost something. It's out of because your perfection is going to be compromised. In Iftitah, when it says Mashku Ilai, it's in relation to Faqda Nabiyyana, in relation to the absence of our Prophet. It's difficult for us, but we're sorrowful in relation to this. There's no one more perfect than the Holy Messenger. But even the other Imams feel this sorrow. So look, why should people do that? Just because they don't understand a wording. Everyone has a threshold. This is over their threshold, and they say, no, this last part isn't part of the dua. That's very sad. With Ziyarat al-Shura, that last part, the last few sentences, the sajda is overwhelmingly accepted at the end. But the last, when they do the la'an over the first, second, and so on and so on, that there is some discussion that some say an Allama Askari, the late Allama Askari, very prominent Iraqi scholar who in history is a'lam by a long way. In a session in the Bomb, when it was asked to him, this last part, what is your position? He said, there's no sanad for it. He said, there's no sanad. He said, this was added later. What we have in the fourth century, that section was not there. In something three or four centuries later, it appeared. Now, this is a historical discussion. What I want to put forth to you is, even if it was added, that last part, we have, first of all, so many ahadith about the importance of Ziyarat al-Shura, numerous. And we have numerous ahadith that if you can't go to Karbala, then every day or once a year, it doesn't matter, from the rooftops of your house, you give your salam and do the ziyarah from afar. And then in those traditions, it says that do ijtihad, struggle, strive a lot in relation to the du'a over the killers of Imam Hussein. Du'a here is Allah cursing, because cursing is also a du'a, but in the negative sense. It says, strive a lot. Now, the scholars, during certain phases throughout the centuries, Sahmun ata min janib al-Khalifa. What happened with Imam Hussein, the arrow was fired by the hands of the Khalifa, referring to first, second, what they did. And then it says, وَقَوْسُهُ عَلَى يَدِ الْخَلِيفَ. The bow was in the hand of the Khalifa. So what happened in Karbala? The killers, it goes back, they trace it back to him. And then in those ahadith which give the importance and emphasize the importance of the others is you strive hard with the la'an over the killers. Now, let's say scholars added it. Sometimes Sayyid Ibn Tawus, which is the 8th century after Hijrah, he even says, I added this dua I've written. even says it. He says, this door I have written from beginning to end. Is that wrong? We'll come to that. It's not. But I'll explain why. So this doesn't mean you have to neglect the door, the Ziora. And it would be a pity, the scholars have said at this, assuming that's the case, although it has its opposition too. But even if that was added, because proving it is very difficult, but even if it was added, why do you neglect it? The content is purely on a par with the instruction of the Imam. This is important. Sometimes the dua has a strong chain of transmission, but the differences in the different chains of transmission is very significant. Here you say the meaning has been conveyed, but this is certainly the majority, isn't the word of the Imam. Hadith in Kesa is like this. The chain of sanad is definitely strong. There's no doubt about it. Even the Sunnis have, you know, the chains of transmission. But what we can say is, because of so many differences in the chains of transmission, what we say is the content is pure. It's on a par with the Quran and our Ahadith. But to say it's the word of the Imam, we can't really say that. We can't say most of it is the word of the Imam. But the meaning has been conveyed. You see, this, the discrepancies are a lot compared to Ziyarat al-Shura and other doors. But it has a strong sanad. So we shouldn't just throw it away as a whole. Sometimes there's a sanad, there's a chain of narration, but it's weak. It's weak, i.e., for the reason I explained, either the reliability of the narrators or the chain is not complete. But there is a chain, but we say it's incomplete and therefore weak. Here, we can't say 100% it's not authentic at all. It just happened to be through a weak narrator, or we don't have access to the full chain. That doesn't mean it's definitely inauthentic or it doesn't exist. Okay, so that's one thing. And he gets the scholars, even with these weak ones, they look at the meaning. And when you see a lofty meaning, which is on a par with the Quran, is on a par with other ahadith, they say this compensates for the weakness. They don't throw it away, they don't put it aside. And sometimes there's no sanad. There's a dua just come, and there's no sanad whatsoever, no chain of narrators. What do we do there? I remember Ayatollah Wahid Khorasani, he once said to me in person, he said, whatever is in Mafati should have was for me. This was my beginning days of when I went to war more than 20 years ago. He said, whatever is in Mafati is authentic. He said, let that be your program. Whatever you encounter there. He said this. In Mafati is a dua. Seifi Sarir. Like the minor sword, if you like. There, this only a few years ago, I came across this. Sheikh Abbas Ummi, the compiler, who was a very sincere man, the fact that how Mafati has really spread everywhere, shows this. When he comes to this door, he puts it in this book. He says, I have not seen a sanad for this, but my ustad, I can't remember the name, has placed this in this book of du'as. And I've seen the meaning. My ustad has attributed it to Amir al-Mu'mineen, I have seen no sanad. This is in Mafati. On the margins it's written. I have seen no sanad, no chain of transmission for it. But my ustad has brought this door. He's attributed to Amir al-Mu'mineen. I've looked at the meaning. It's very good. So I'll bring it. And he brought it. And you know, that door is one of the doors of Ibn Arabi. Ibn Arabi has a book of doors where he's written the doors himself. And it's exactly the same wording. The point I'm trying to make is, let's say a door even has no sanad whatsoever. If it's on a par with the Quran, it doesn't go in conflict with the Quran, what's wrong with reciting it? Dua is dua. Your heart wants to get closer to Allah through du'as. And Sayyid ibn Tawus, one of the great scholars, everyone accepts him from the 7th, 8th century. He says, I have written many du'as. We're allowed to do that. What's Imam Sadiq in Al-Kafi, in the compendium of Ahadith, Al-Kafi, he gives a du'a, he says, Ya Muqallib al-Qulub. One of the companions says, well, absurd. He says, no, don't add that. There are some du'as where the Imam are very meticulous. This du'a has to be said like this. In Al-Kafi, the section on du'a. Those du'as are mostly, you can say with confidence, or strong chain of narrations, and the meaning and the words are mostly from the Imam. But sometimes the Imam says, no, don't add that. Because this du'a has a specific purpose. But if you, other than that du'a, you want to write your own du'a and you add wal absar and you want to write another du'a, there's nothing wrong with that. It's not haram. And many of the great scholars have written du'as and they've, you know, confessed that this is our du'a. We want to give this to the people and people are benefiting from it. So this is how we have to look at du'as and ziyarat. Don't pass it away. Especially in this tariq of Sayyid Ali Qadi's ziyarat al-Ashura, it's very important. That last section has a number of cursing in relation to certain people. Do we have to other du'as which curse the first and second? The answer is yes, albeit one or two. But from the beginning of ziyarat al-Ashura, cursing and la'an is a prominent feature. Some people have a problem with this. As I say, the threshold is different. So I want to just explain what this la'an is with your permission. Although you all know what it is from a zahiri point of view. And that's okay. A zahiri point of view in relation to la'an is important. But there's a batini meaning to la'an also. If we have both, it would be better. And you would be growing if you know and practice the batini la'an. You'll be growing with the zahiri la'an too, but you'll be growing more when you have both. So la'an is when you want to distance something from yourself. When a mother wants to distance a child from, let's say, chocolate or whatever, they would say il'al, be distanced from whatever it is. And in the technical meaning, the technical religious meaning here, is you being distanced from Allah's mercy. And if Allah's mercy is cut from you in this world, you die. Imam Khomeini in his 40 Ahadith, he says that in Islamic sentencing, for example, if someone, God forbid, performs an act which is haram, like adultery, homosexuality, they do it in the open, witnesses, it's in an Islamic country, and so on and so forth. See, what the sentencing is, you have to end their life. They've done something somewhere in front of some people in a manner which they've blackened their souls through this action. If they had done it inside the house, the ruling wouldn't be this. But they did it in a particular manner that entails the blackening of the soul so much that they will never amend their ways. Islam says, end their life. But Islam, Imam says Islam, Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah, he says, Islam says, end your life for their own betterment. Islam does this out of compassion, because if you don't end their life with the pollution they have acquired for themselves, if they will continue to live, they will just become worse and worse and worse. The protocol of Islam is the dunya and the hereafter. We don't look at the dunya then full stop. There's a hereafter. Islam even cares for this sinner. So it's better if we end your life. And if you do tawbah, so much the better. But your life has to be ended. And this is for your own good. Because if you weren't, if your life wasn't to be ended, you would continue sinning. So look, Islamic sentencing is out of compassion. Now, here, if you were to curse someone and say, oh Allah, disconnect them from your mercy, what you're saying is, oh Allah, end his life. This you can only do when it's substantiated to you that this person can't amend their ways. And that is, for me and you, very difficult. Yes, with the Netanyahu's of the time and certain other individuals, yes, it's easy. They will never amend their ways. But for your neighbor, your friend, your close relative, okay, they've done something wrong, and you suddenly curse them, that's definitely wrong, because it's not substantiated before you. And Imam Khomeini's mentor, Shah Abbas, said, be careful with cursing, because if it's not legitimate, the side effects for you would be gross. And he added that, how do you know this person may change the final minute and you've cursed them? So it's not something, it's a truth, it's a reality, but it's not something we just do nilly-willy. So we don't do it, just, but the potential is there. But in, when we see the Ziyarata of Shura, and the Imams have taught us who to say la to, then we do it. Because we have that confidence in the Imam. This is like, I'm just trying to highlight the philosophy of this, that, you know, in hospitals, there's something called DNRs, do not resuscitate. Let's say a patient comes and says, put a DNR over my head in this hospital bed. I don't want to be resuscitated. The Muslim doctor can't listen to that, especially if the patient is a Muslim. It doesn't matter right now if they're Muslim or not. He says, no, we're not about it. This is ending your life. They may say, I don't want to go through the pain and suffering. The Muslim doctor will say, this pain and suffering is cleansing you. It's for your own betterment. We're not allowed to end it on purpose. We're not allowed to expedite your death. See the philosophy here? So if your loved parents, for example, sometimes say that, just put a DNR and get rid of me, as offspring of that parent, if you truly want the best for them, you should never accept. And if you do, you will be answerable in the hereafter. I can give many examples like that, but I don't want to divert. Okay, so that's, but the problem now is, what if a person has passed away? Someone is dead now. They died 1400 years ago. Why do Latin on them? What's the philosophy here? You're saying La'an is cutting them off from Allah's mercy. They're dead now. Oh, this is becoming a bit intricate here now. There are three answers. They're all okay. Two answers, I think. The first one is it's an educational thing. And when you do learn on certain individuals, to be educated that these individuals did dhulm, did oppression. So if you see a Muawiyah today, you also do the same. And you fear that person, the Muawiyah of today. You plan against that person. You speak against that person. It's an educational tool that you see who are the Umar Sats of today, who are the Muawiyahs of the Qasid only respected 1400 years ago. I always tell the brothers that if me and you had the wealth and the status of the Pharaoh, we would have done exactly what the Pharaoh did. It's just that we don't have the means before us. So we see who are the Muawiyahs, but this land that we do is an educational tool, so it helps us to recognize the oppressed of today. Now, I think on the 19th of August, there are going to be processions. This is just my very humble opinion. You don't have to accept this, but I just want to mention something. And some of these processions, the organizers say no political statements. For example, like death to America, or end the atrocities in Palestine. Allahu Akbar, they say don't add this. They say this is a religious procession, not political. But if you believe religion and politics, politics being that management of a society to perfection, if this is one, and then you take out one aspect of it by saying no political chance, that procession is going to be cultural. That's why you see sometimes they bring the trumpets and the drums and everything. You've lost the identity. So, but don't get me wrong. Now, someone may say, so shouldn't we go? Go. Because going there at least is better than if there was no procession. But this is sad to see. It's an American form of Islam, which Imam Khomeini said. When we take the political aspect out, this is an Islam which America favors. This is American Islam. It's not Muhammadan Islam. All the prophets said, La ilaha illallah, and refrain from the Talmud. We can't accept this. Now, however, who are we? When you see the representatives of the Maraji or of the leader, when they are there and have given the stamp of approval, we say, okay, there must be something that they see for the best interest of us, and we don't see. We submit to them. They are the representatives. So even though theoretically there's a problem with such a procession, but in practical terms, something there that we may not see. But we can't go against the representatives. That's wrong. That's wrong. That can't be acceptable. Speak to them, tell them that why this is happening. But once the representative says, we say we submit. Okay, that was the first in relation to those who have passed away and need Latin education. The second is this. When the person was alive, Latin was the cutting of mercy in this world, meaning they would die. But mercy is of two types. Rahmani mercy and Rahimi mercy. With Rahimi mercy, Allah's being Rahim is His mercy that He takes those who strive towards heaven. For those who have passed away, when you do lag, you're praying for a cutting off of their mercy, Allah's mercy over them, but you're saying that Allah cut him off from your Rahimi mercy. What's the result of that? They will be prolonged in hell. Because Allah's Rahimi mercy is cut off. Rahimi mercy. When they were alive, it was the Rahmani mercy for the reasons I gave. Now for the dead, Rahimi mercy. These individuals, the vicious legacies they've left, it's through La'an that they remain in hell. And they will remain until the end. Me and you, if we go to hell, after burning, and no one is doing La'an on us when we're dead, inshallah, after we burn for the sins that we've done, they'll take us to heaven. But for some, there'll always be hell. And this is a discussion that there's difference of opinion. That we believe in eternal hell. Where is the difference of opinion? Is there eternal torture and suffering or not? Is it possible that you're in hell forever? But then you become used to it after a period of time. Like, for example, you go to a sauna, 60 degrees Celsius, for example. In the beginning, it's very difficult, but over a period of time, you get used to it. And there's a difference of opinion here, and it seems that we believe that eternal hell is a definite. Some people will be in hell forever. But although this is my personal preference, when I've seen the different opinions, it seems that eternal suffering we don't have. It's interesting that the two camps, so we believe they'll be in hell forever, but whether there'll be eternal suffering, and they'll be burning forever, they're even burning forever, but whether they'll be suffering forever, there's a difference of opinion. Ayatollah Hassan Zahri, for example, says no. Ayatollah Jawadi only says yes. Ibn Arabi says no. Different. But it's out of interest. There's one verse that they both use to support themselves. It's the same verse. And the verse is in chapter 22. It says, كُلَّمَا أَرَادُوا أَن يَخْرُجُوا مِنْهَا مِنْ غَمْ. Whenever they want to exit out of sorrow, out of pain, they want to exit from hell, أُعِيدُوا فِيهَا, they'll be returned into hell. وَذُوقُوا عَذَابَ الْحَرِيرِ, and they'll be told that taste the burning azab, the burning punishment. So those who say there is eternal suffering, they say no. Whenever they want to come out, they'll be put back in again, and this will continue. So the verse says, كُلَّمَا أَرَادُوا أَن يَخْرُجُوا, whenever they will to exit. Some people, they won't will. They won't will to exit hell because of the sins that they've done and on a par with their status. That's what they want. And they won't ever desire or decide or want to come out. I think I've spoken too much. I'll just give one example and we'll finish. Forgive me for the example, but for example, you're on the streets and you're doing a number of things and you have to go to the toilet, lavatory. And let's say it's an emergency now, like number two, for example. And you can't control it anymore. And that's your own doing, what you ate and you didn't go earlier and everything. It's an emergency. Someone comes to you and says, there are two places I can show you. One is a very dark, smelly pit. The other is a luxurious restaurant with kebabs ready for you. Which one would you choose? It's the pit. That the kebabs are a source of torture for such a person. So, God forbid, if we sin so much, we can never want heaven. The soul is so polluted that we become ahlun nar, ahlun nar. That yes, we're suffering in hell, over a period of time, since heaven is not an option for us because of our status quo, then nor the fire become acquainted with it, at will not. And we have traditions that they play with the fire and the spiders, they play with it. Before they were suffering with it, they were being burnt. They're still being burnt, but they've become used to it now. Okay. But the point was, look, this lad with the underlying philosophy of it. If one lives like that now, every day, when encountering people, when encountering ideologies, that the person is growing. That's a strong slogan. But the Osho becomes incorporated into your heart, or someone more.